right, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and whenever you are. You're back on the Asian Highway. This is our Storytellers in Action podcast. We are in season 5. This is episode 10, recording on October 10. It's a 10-10-10, a perfect 10. And I will be happy to tell you that we have a perfect 10 of a guest today. I'll introduce her in a second. Today is 24 days away from the election. Your reminder to get out there and vote. It's an important election, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in today's episode at some point. And speaking of today's episode, I'd like to introduce my dear friend. I hope I say her name right. I've been practicing this all week. Anisha Adusimile. Did I say that right, Anisha?
Yes, you did.
Nice.
10-2. Gold star.
Nice, thank you. Well, Anisha, real quick, before we start talking, let me brag about you a little bit. You are an actor. I believe you do some writing as well. You are the Peruvial, came from the Midwest story and pursued a career in acting in Hollywood, and you are making it. We'll talk about some of the shows and movies you worked on. And I want to say you had an appearance in How I Met Your Mother. Is that right?
I did.
What else have you had an appearance in? Kind of give me the list. What are your favorites that you've appeared in?
Oh, that I've appeared in? I really do love them all. But, you know, the popular ones are Lucifer. I was a New Girl back in the day. Yeah, like you said, what did you say?
How I Met Your Mother?
Yeah. Right. I did a little stint on Days of Our Lives. What else? NCIS Los Angeles. A newer one that people like that has a great following is All American on CW. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So different things like that.
Okay. There was another one you started with. I think it was like a last season, 5 or 6 episodes. Was it BIFO?
Oh, yeah.
Is that right?
Well, yeah. BIFO.
Okay.
Yeah. That's on YouTube. And then there's another series, that's on Amazon Prime called Bulge Bracket.
Okay, okay. Tell us about BIFL or Biffle. I'm not sure how to say it.
Biffle?
Tell us about that episode or that series.
Yeah, totally. It's an LGBT web series. It's 6 episodes, and I play the lead character, Jill, in it. And it's really just about some friends that live together, and they're all just navigating their feelings. So I feel like it's, in a sense, like a queer friends, basically. And it's just a cool project because it was one of those things where the writer, Kelsey, they were living in Chicago and they had connected with some people who wanted to make something cool and collaborate creatively here in LA. And somehow the script landed with each other, and then they crowdfunded over 50K, and then we made this series, and it's gotten over almost 100,000 views on YouTube. Like, it's just a really cool thing, you know, when people come together and when creativity just becomes its own thing. It was so awesome.
Nice. And that was out last year, and last year seems like an eternity ago.
Can you believe it?
Right? I mean, I met you 9 months ago, and it felt like I met you 90 years ago. It just, time is what that slow.
I can't believe we met 9 months ago. That's wild.
Right? I mean, but it feels like forever ago. I mean, that's how strange and crazy 2020's been.
Yeah, we're in a warp. We're in some type of warp. Yeah.
Yeah. But I have to believe, and we'll talk more about this here in a second, but I have to believe, this is just my philosophy in life, that everything it warrants a reaction of its opposite. So if something good happens, it's going to be balanced out by something that's not so good, and vice versa. Something bad happens, it will be balanced out by something good. So I have to believe that what we're going through this year, you know, and RIP to everyone who's died this year, both from the pandemic and naturally from other causes, you know, a shout out to all those souls. But, you know, I have to believe the suffering we went through this year will be paid off, if not next year, the year after that. Somehow things will come back and we'll be better and badder than ever.
Yeah.
Just what do you want to share about that? How do you feel about the future as of today?
Yeah, I think it's, there's just so many levels to it. I think collectively we're suffering, you know, mm-hmm. in America. That's for sure. But I also think individually, certain people I think that I've known or even myself have had time to go deep inside and internally and heal something. So it's interesting to have that juxtaposition where maybe personally you've developed in certain ways and grown a lot in certain ways because of this time and the pause that we've had to be at home with ourselves. But then collectively, you know, I hope that we do come together and begin to rebuild and heal as a you know, a communal group, you know, in this country. But individually, I hope that it continues to stay positive for the people that maybe have had positive time. I hope that reaction just continues to grow versus balancing out with the negative. Because I do know certain people that have focused on, you know, really healthy habits during this time.
Right. And, you know, and look, we all go through our emotions, I believe. And, you know, like for me, I've evolved a lot over these past 9-10 months, yeah. Right? I mean, I look at where I was even just in January, February, which mm-hmm. again, feels like years ago, but just where I was at the beginning of this year and where I am today, like I'm now producing and editing my own podcasts, that alone is a skill set I've learned just how to do, right? I'm expanding a lot of my other business ventures. I focus on becoming a better writer. So I had to, because the gym was not open for the longest time, I had to find new ways to stay in shape. And so just the way this period, at least for me personally, how it's forced me to find new ways to be productive and avoiding, because one thing I can't stand about me, and this is me personally, I can't stand going backwards in life. Like I am where I am, this wherever I am at a particular day, that's got to be my baseline going forward. Like I can never go beneath that baseline at any point in my life. And I think for me, there's very little I fear, but I fear going backwards. That is one of my biggest fears in life, one of my biggest insecurities in life. Right. And I think that was, for me, that was the hardest part of 2020, was how to prevent myself from going backwards into a life that I didn't want to have anymore. And I don't know, I mean, that was my struggle, my journey. I know everybody's got their own struggles and their own journeys. Are you comfortable sharing anything on your end? Like what was kind of, if you want to put this in the context of just trying to find work during the pandemic, because, you know, it's been hard on Hollywood. What have you done to kind of keep yourself sane and busy?
I have not been trying to be so busy, to be honest. I've been trying to practice slower living during the time, which has been good for me, because living in LA, it's such a, you know, we're all so busy. It just, that's just, I think, how a lot of people identify here in this town. But I think my personal growth has been, I did some of the same things as you in the beginning. I had started taking a TV writing class, and I went through like 3 to 4 months of just like, you know, I even got into an accountability partnership, and we would be like, okay, we're writing at this time today. And I studied TV structure, because I had approached it from an acting point of view for a long time. So to learn the other point of view and learn it technically was like my skill set I was trying to learn. And then after I started getting in that rhythm, then I just started to enjoy the time outside of the gym. I started being in nature a lot more, because we were just in the middle of spring. So I walked around and I noticed that I just loved looking at the plants starting to grow. I became super simple, you know. I was like, oh my God, these flowers are beautiful. And what are these flowers? I've never seen these before. So I think that's been my major growth in terms of learning to be much more present in my life and trying to tune into where I'm at in this moment and what I truly want and need for myself in this moment, and still the ongoing journey of what would actually bring me joy right now. I mean, truly, it's been a simple spiritual experience for me. And then, yeah, the other practices I do are meditating and journaling, but even in the last month, I've fallen off a little bit. But for the first, you know, several months, I was really diving deep into that.
You know, it's great to hear this, because it's a good reminder. I mean, I think the one thing that's interesting in terms of us two is you actually came from the Midwest. I've been born and raised here in LA. So there are things that I take for granted that I didn't even think about. For example, like you were saying, like, this is a busy town. Like, for me, I'm like, I don't even think about that because it's just normal. Like, that's the hustle and bustle of LA is so etched in my DNA that I don't even think about the craziness that is the city. And it's so ingrained in my head that even during the pandemic, I never had a thought to like, hey, let me slow down. Like, well, no, this is the way life is. Like, you got to keep yourself busy all the time.
Yeah.
And even though it's not like I don't think about being present. I mean, I do try to enjoy life. And today, by the way, is National Mental Health Awareness Day. I think that's the right phrasing of it. But I do try to pay attention to my mental health as much as I can every day. Like I go to the beach regularly to meditate. That's something I've been doing for decades. So it's not to say that I don't pay attention to my mental health, but I'm so used to like having to do, like having to have a full day.
I think like, that, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was gonna say just to finish, like, yeah, I don't know another life. And I wonder for you if that's kind of your juxtaposition, because I don't know how it is growing up in the Midwest. And I don't know, like, I believe you're from Northwest Ohio, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. Toledo, right. So, I mean, just comparing the life you had there to the life you have here, I mean, did that give you that kind of insight? This is truly an ignorant, silly question. So feel free to slap me if I'm going down the wrong path here.
Well, I'll have to give you a virtual slap.
You can do that, like slap. But I'm just kind of curious how being from a different city, just a different region of this country, kind of gives you perspective to handle the craziness that is 2020.
I don't know. I came out here right after high school. So I think possibly, but I think, you know, technology just increased. So I think with that, I'm not sure. I am actually going to be spending December in Toledo. So I'm curious to see what the lifestyle will be like. I'm sure I'll be so bored out of my mind. I might be busier there because I want to like overcompensate for how slow it's going to be there. But I maybe possibly the small town living, you know, it still was a city, but the small town living versus being in LA, I really think driving in LA is a big time suck. So that would cause so much, you know, during the times I wasn't driving before the pandemic kicked in, it was just like, oh my God, there's so much to do in the time when I'm not driving. And then even when I'm driving, I'm trying to educate myself via podcasts or something. It was just always like being productive, you know? And so now with a, you know, let's say 2 hours less of drive time every day, you know, minimum, I would say, it's just a lot more space in my life. And that space is so nice.
Totally agree. I want to make a comment about the driving part because I noticed something. And this was a personal observation about me, but you're talking about the time suck of driving really hit home right now. So like I said, I live on the border of LA and Orange County. So I'm a good 30 miles from where you are.
Right.
And the drive, I mean, I've lived here my entire life in this part of town. And since I've been out of high school, I've been going from where I live to portions of LA for every day for decades. I mean, it's from 1994 until now, that's 26 years of constantly going back and forth between the county line and the heart of LA. And it became so routine, I stopped thinking about it, right? Just like I stopped thinking about the busyness of LA, right? And then the pandemic hit, and naturally, I dramatically reduced my driving because now I have no reason to be in LA.
Yeah.
Right? Other than to see people I care about. But that's few and far between in terms of time, right? And so maybe 6 weeks ago, a friend of mine who lives in Santa Monica invited me to have a picnic with her, you know, overlooking the Palisades Park, overlooking the ocean. And I'm like, cool, this is one of my old college friends. I haven't seen her in a couple of years. Why not, right? And we set all the rules down, wear masks, bring a beach chair so we can sit apart from each other, all that stuff, right? We did the whole social distancing protocol. And I drove and I started getting bored. I'm like, holy crap, this is what I go through every day. Like, I didn't realize, it hit me like, no wonder my friends barely come see me. This is a bad drive. And keep in mind, there was no traffic.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. When you were asking me that question about Ohio, I think it sounds like for you, you've just been on autopilot with the way your routine has been or the lifestyle you've lived, versus now we have the opportunity to actually analyze or consider that routine and be like, because I wasn't driving for a long time either. I mean, there were weeks where I didn't even take my car out, or even a couple weeks, maybe even just driving it once a month. But I was like, once I started driving, I was like, oh my God, this is so uncomfortable. You know, you just don't realize it. You're literally just, you do what you do and you don't even think about it.
Yeah, you know, and like I said, for me, it was 26 years in the building, you know, in the making. I mean, since I finished, and even before, like, hey, heck, because my parents were also very active people, and even as a kid, we would go to LA regularly. So, like, I've been used to being out and about my entire life. My parents would take me out on the weekends to their family parties or friends parties, and we get home at 1 a.m. on weekends. So, and these are parties or gatherings in Santa Monica or in the Valley or in South Orange County. And it was normal to go an hour away to see somebody and come back. And it was so routine. And like I said, so much on autopilot that, like you said, now it's like, wow, I can't believe since, like, for as long as I can remember, this was the life I lived.
Totally.
And I'm sad now. What I'm analyzing now is, what part of that did I actually enjoy and what didn't I enjoy? Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer yet.
Right.
But I'm definitely analyzing it now.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of us are. I don't think this is just a me thing. I think I'm really speaking to the choir right here, right?
Yeah, I think that's the value of, for me, what I've experienced is the value of the open time that I've had allows me to then analyze my values in a sense, you know, like I'm just talking about how I've walked outside a lot more because that's been my main form of exercise. And I'm going to the beach so much more because, I mean, not really hanging out during the day, but to go for walks, you know, in the evenings or things like that, because traffic's a lot less, or at least during the beginning of quarantine. And I'm realizing how much I get out of being in nature, you know, as simple as that is, and how maybe we've heard that our whole lives, but to truly feel that in my body, I've been like, wow, this is a big part of my life that I need.
So where would you, I mean, if you could, this is, you know, I'm asking you the impossible, I think, right now, or at least it's a tough question. So I acknowledge that going into this, but where would you like to see the next 2 years of your life go? I mean, I'm assuming that by 2022, we're going to, hopefully things will start to get back to normal. So when we're getting back to our routine lives, what have you learned, or what are you learning from now? And what would you like to see yourself implement? Not saying that this has to be a perfect solution, but with where you are now, what would you like to see yourself become?
Like a beach house in Malibu? No, I'm just no, I think that is a challenging question to answer, Parmal. But honestly, I would like to... I would like to be able to make the choices, just as you said, where it's like, is this actually making me feel fulfilled right now? And is this actually making me feel more alive right now? And do I feel joy more than I feel fear or sadness or pain? You know, of course we can't not feel those things sometimes, but can I feel like I'm living this rich, full life? That's what I feel like the opportunity has been. And I hope that I can do more of those activities as the next couple of years go on and stick to that and have the, you know, the guts and the courage to stick to that versus being bombarded by all of the things that used to happen in my schedule, you know?
Right. Okay. So I'm gonna raise the stakes here. I'm gonna call your call and raise you for a second here.
Okay, what?
So in the context of what you just said, I'm gonna now extend this to what I mentioned at the beginning of the show, that we are 24 days away from an election.
Right.
what does the world look like in the context of what's at stake? I mean, and if you could take what you said now, take that up to us as a society, what challenges would we face if, let's just say, Trump wins? What does the world look like if Biden wins? Kind of in your lens, walk us through what you think are the two paths we have in front of us in the next 20 days.
I think we have the opportunity to start choosing connection. I think if we choose that choice, I think probably away from Trump would allow for more connection, I think, because we've seen the huge divide. And I think that's what I really feel is necessary. And it's not just connection. I think, you know, with the civil unrest that's going on, and that's been going on, and that has been so deeply illuminated right now, I think what people really want is to be heard and to be acknowledged and to not be dismissed. And so that people can start continuing to listen and start working together and actually taking action that makes a difference. That's really what I believe. I think we keep getting stuck because everyone's trying to say their side.
And I actually put that, this is a constant theme I've been, I guess, preaching or at least advocating for all season, is that fully comes on a simple concept of leadership, right? And this is where, like, my politics, I've not been shy about it. I am anti-Trump. For at least the simple, at least the first layer of, he lacks leadership. Because I do believe a true leader would not allow this climate to exist, right? People are always going to have their differences. There are 330 million people in this country. We're never going to come to agreement on anything. I mean, it's hard to get two people. I mean, I could guarantee you, Anisha, there are going to be plenty of times if me and you will have a situation where we don't agree on something, right? I mean, it is what it is, right?
It's okay.
Exactly, it's okay. And so what's needed is to have the right person at the helm of the ship to say, despite your differences, despite your disagreements, here's a common goal for all of us to go to. And I think what's sad about this past 4 years is the lack of leadership at the top has allowed us to have a country now where we have the perception of two different Americas.
Right.
And that I never felt, I mean, and I'm 43 years old and all my life, and I've been following politics since I was five. So since Reagan's early days as president, right? I remember watching the 1984 debates. I mean, I remember watching Geraldine Ferraro being the first, you know, female person on the ticket, right? And that was a great moment. And so I've been following politics literally for as long as I can remember. And I never once felt like there were two different views of what America should be. I always felt like no matter your politics, there was still a common thread of like, we're Americans. We're trying to go one direction. We just have a different philosophy how to get there. But that difference has now been so convoluted now that it's no longer two different views to one common goal. It's two paths to two polar opposite goals.
Yes.
And I really believe that the right leader in place could really change that. Like, you're going to have your little tail end effectors here or there, but you'll have enough people, the critical mass, that will get on board and say, okay, look, we have our differences, but like you said, we have to work together and we have to find a way to get there despite our differences. And I think that's the starting point we have to work towards. I don't know if Joe Biden is a long-term answer for that, but I do think he's the answer for right now to at least, if he is elected, and I am hoping he is, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but I'll finish with this point of, if he is elected, I do believe he's a starting point to make us look back at some point and say, hey, you know what? Those 4 years of the Trump era and were literally the worst 4 years we experienced. We weren't savvy enough to see in the moment, but looking back, holy shit, what did we do to ourselves?
Right.
So I'm kind of curious, like, do you think that, where do you see this as being our, what is the first step we need to get, or that we need to take to get to where we need to go?
Well, I want to ask you, I think when you're talking about leadership, I feel like, you know, but I don't know politics, but I feel like we lack authenticity at the core. It's just like we're not even in a reality, you know? We don't even get facts from our leadership, you know? So I feel like I wish that was what we started with. I wish we had a reset where it was like, here's the truth, here's authenticity, let's start to accept that, and then let's start to make choices from there, you know? What do you think about that?
I think you couldn't have said it better. I think that's exactly the point. And I think that's how you show leadership, right? I mean, I know speaking in a vacuum, but to take it one step further, yeah, I this is where I have faith in people, that when people see an authentic person at the top, they respond, and they respond the right way. I've seen in my own situations, in my own, you know, little vacuums, in my own little silos, like, because I'm in a leadership position, I'm an editor of a newspaper, and I have multiple people who report to me. I have a large 100,000 people readership that responds to my work. And I have a vision of how I share my information, of how I put facts out there. 95% of my readers are Trump supporters. Okay. And none of them push back on me. I am not a Trump supporter. I'm one of the 5% who isn't in that camp. And yet I'm writing articles. I'm not saying no one's accusing me of fake news or alternate facts. Our stories are well received because I present my work in authentic manner. I deal with my staff in authentic manner. I care for them. I work with them. I don't command them. I work with them. They're my team, right? And that authenticity shows up in the pudding. The proof is in the pudding, right? And I truly believe that word authenticity is the right word. I mean, you hit it on the nail, because I think that is what is truly lacking more than leadership. I think we need authentic leadership. And when you have people who are, and this is on both sides, okay? I don't want to make this just a Trump thing. There are Democrats who are just as guilty of this, of being disingenuous and catering to a specific personal agenda. And until that changes, what we're going through right now, sadly, might become the norm. I do believe, and this is my personal belief, that Obama came from a position of authenticity, which is why many people responded to him. And I think that's the point, is you're right, Anisha, it needs a level of authenticity and a level of truly connecting with people and saying, I'm with you, let's do this together.
Yeah.
So that's my response to your question.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. There's a lot there. And it is not just the leadership. You know, we're humans, which, I mean, ultimately we are animals, and our bodies do react. You know, we feel things. It's not just, you know, the words people are saying. We feel it, you know, and that's going to allow us to also come together if we feel that from the top or from the core.
Right. So this is probably the most interesting episode in the sense that I think in the previous 9 episodes, there were crazy things that happened the week before. This past week has been relatively tame. I mean, the most dramatic thing we've seen happen is a fly land on Mike Pence's head during a debate, which was hilarious. And then we had, they're talking about moving forward with the Supreme Court nomination, which may start in a couple of days. And the governor of Michigan had a kidnapping plot lodged against her. I want to talk about the kidnapping plot because that worries me. I'm glad the FBI stepped in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to preface what I'm going to say with this idea. People were always talking about, oh, it's going to be civil war because it seems like that great, we're set so high odds right now that the tensions are going so wild that this is going to end in just us fighting with each other, right? And maybe this is me being naive. I never believed that for a moment because I think a lot of people are cock that when it comes down to actually, you know, implementing violence on the streets, they won't do it on both sides. And so I was hopeful that, everyone's talking about doing stuff, but no one's going to actually do it. And then you hear this, and that made me pause, like, wait a second, maybe people aren't being, you know, all talk. Maybe there is going to be some form of action that is scary. And, you know, to the form of like, hey, I'm going to take over the government because I disagree with them. What do you think is, have we reached a critical mass of any sort? Is there a threat of violence out there? Or will this all just get, is there a way we'll just calm it down several notches and just move forward?
I think there's certainly a possibility of violence. I don't know. I don't think we can go past that. I mean, I don't think everyone lives in that place. I think a majority of people are more down the middle, to be honest, and probably live more balanced. And we're talking about mental health today. So I think a lot of that may be coming down to mental health challenges. And then also when we're talking about authenticity from the top down, I think there's a lack of trust. I feel like we are all living on shaky ground. So everyone's freaking out and they feel a ton of fear inside. And so that's a trauma response in a sense, you know, to go towards violence for a lot of people. And it's when you don't feel taken care of, you know, we don't feel taken care of by our country and by our systems. And I think it's totally a possibility. I want to say, you know, we can all just say, don't fight, you know, like wave our hand no and just stop doing that. I wish we could say that. And maybe some people will actually listen to that if our leadership said, don't do that, be smart, you know, and be responsible and care for each other. But I also think that won't help some people.
Right. You mentioned what I like to call a bell curve. That you said most people are kind of balanced in the middle. Mm-hmm. And so I went to law school. Mm-hmm. And one thing we did in law school was the way grading was done was in a bell curve. So, you know, 48% of the students were literally in the middle of the curve. That was the bulk of your curve. And then you had your tail ends. And it's the very far tail end to the right. You had your top 1%ers. On the tail end of the left at your bottom 1%ers. So it was basically like 1%, 1%. And then there was breaks. Basically it broke down such a way that you look at 50% on both sides, right? It's like 24 plus 12 plus 12 plus 1 plus 1. And that adds to 50% on each side, right? And politics is no different, right? I mean, our lifestyles or politics, it's also the same kind of breakdown of most Americans are somewhere in the middle. We're a hybrid of Democrat and Republican, right? There's some things we believe that are leading left, some things that we believe are leading right. That's where most Americans are. And I was saying this last episode where what's happening now, what we're going through is the 1%ers on both extremes, even the 2% on both extremes are no longer the small tails. They are now, they've raised that up and right. They've suppressed the middle 48%.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's what I really believe is going on now. And I don't know how to fix that, but we have to find some way to wrangle in the extremes. Because that's what's happening. When you hear, for example, you know, the people on the right talk about the left being rioters and we're about anarchy. That's only 1% of the left, right? Or left, should go this way. Right? 1% of our left, right? And the same thing, like the militia, or they're 1% of the right. It's so far extreme. And hey, look, let's just do the math, right? I said this last week too. 1% of 333 million is still 3.3 million. That's a lot of people. So of course, when you hear 3.3 million, that's the size of LA. Imagine everybody in LA saying the same thing. Well, it's going to sound like it's crazy, even though percentage-wise, it's tiny, right? So I think that's also part of it. I think you're so right to say it's the reality is that most people are within this middle here, you know, and very few people follow these extreme points. But for some reason, the people in the middle, their voices have been muted. Well, the people in the extremes, they're speaking out of megaphones.
Yeah, and the attention is going towards the extremes, so that amplifies it also.
Right, right. So I don't know how to fix that. I mean, you know, at least one thing I'm trying to do here with this podcast and talking to people with like you and the articles we write is to try to be that voice of reason and hey, this is what the reality is, you know, like... Let's talk about that, something on this topic. We talked about this before recording. I mentioned something to you that Hollywood, despite the perceptions out there, is truly a working class industry. Yes, you have your elites, but it's no different from any other industry. But let's talk about just being somebody in Hollywood. Like, you're not this person out there who's trying to do this puppeteering and be like, hey, you're going to fight. I'm going to take these roles and make you think a very specific way. You are from what I know about you, and you are a very sensible, reasonable, sweet person. And you are the kind of person I think represent what most Americans would like to be, right? Just sensible, well-rounded, responsible. You go about life the best you can. What can we do to kind of show more of this side of us that, you know, we're not really these labels that you might think we are. We're really, end of the day, we're just everyday people.
Oh, that's nice of you, Parmal. I don't know. I honestly think that comes down to people who want to tell stories, whether you're in the industry or not, picking up a camera or picking up a pen or getting a laptop and actually finishing something that you want to say and putting it out there. I just think it comes down to that because truly content is queen, content is king. Like if you can get, you know, your opinion and your heart out there and then people want to see that. I really think that. And right now, Hollywood doesn't really have all the power right now because they can't fully do production. So I'm making small projects with people in my pod, and I think other people are as well. And I don't know, maybe then Hollywood will have to buy those things because that's the content that's able to be made.
Yeah, yeah, and maybe that's part of the, you know, it's interesting, like, despite all the badness right now, that there might, because of everything that's going on, we might be seeing more regime change, not just in Hollywood, but in other industries as well. I mean, I could tell you the same things start to happen in journalism right now. I mean, this is, I haven't been shy about this, like, what I've been going through this past year. You're kind of aware of this, like, the company I work at, we had one pre-pandemic, we had 5 publications and we're now down to 1. And we had 70 people working at our office pre-Thanksgiving last year. And now we're down to 10. And so the nature of, I do really believe that my company right now is a microcosm of what's going on in journalism, of resources are extremely limited. And it's becoming harder for someone like me. I'm really talented. I'm really good at what I do. But because I don't have resources now, I can't do certain things. I can't do investigative reporting because I have so much regular news to put out there that I can't now turn that off and say, I need to spend, because, you know, investigative stories take time. They take sometimes years to pull off. And I can't put the resources and time into digging into documents, interviewing sources, being out there in the field, and put out news at the same time because I don't have the team anymore. And that's making people like me who are in leadership positions to rethink how to be better at our jobs despite what doesn't happen. Because we can't let these investigative stories go because that's keeping people honest, right? The things I've caught people doing before, I need to keep doing that, right? And so, yeah, like I think it's not just Hollywood; it's multiple industries where now we have to, everything's been turned around upside down its head, and like we have to think about how we recalibrate.
Yeah, it seems like the structures of these industries are shifting massively and almost being democratized, I guess, you know, because the people are kind of, you know, whereas it came from top down, now it almost feels like there's an evening that's happening. And that's, then the, you know, where the top down, the down now feels like the top, you know?
Right, right. And this is, look, because I'm a numbers person. I like, you know, even numbers, and 2020 is an even year. Like it's a nice smooth number. And so now let's look back 10 years and forward 10 years, right? So let's go back to 2010 and look at the world today compared to the world 10 years ago. It's a much different world. Imagine how the world's going to look 10 years from now, right? To put this in the presidential race context, one candidate that intrigued me, I wasn't in his camp in terms of supporting, but I liked some of the things he had to say was Andrew Yang. Mm-hmm. And one thing he was talking about was UBI and technology. And one thing I keep telling people is don't underestimate what's happening right now in terms of the effects of the economy on people. You know, we could talk about all these other craziness going on, but it comes down to one basic thing. A lot of jobs that were taken for granted will be gone in 10 years. And technology will take over much more of our lives, much more than it is now, in 2030. So let's just play it out. Joe Biden, let's say he wins, and then either him or his successor is reelected in 2024. This will be the last presidency, this last administration, that may represent the old era of our economy. We may go through a whole new industrial revolution in the next 8 to 10 years, which is going to have a ripple effect on jobs, and we may need things like UBI. And I don't know how UBI looks like yet. I mean, it's like, all right, give everybody a check, but how do you pay for that? Like, I don't know how that looks like just yet. Speaking of, did you ever watch the Jetsons?
Little bits. Yeah, I remember it.
Okay. What people don't, I don't know if people know this, the Jetsons basically is what the world is going to be looking like in a few years, right? In terms of that show was basically, the concept of UBI was in that show.
Right.
George Jetson worked a couple hours a week, right? He had a robot made, everything's automated. Lacey Sprockets built everything, automation, right? There was very little human work going on. The other thing I don't think people know about Jetsons was it was set in a post-nuclear war United States. Because they made the show in the 60s, right? When we were in the middle of a Cold War. And the reason why the whole town was elevated was because the United States was hit by the Soviets with nuclear weapons, and we couldn't build on the ground anymore. So we had to build a city in the sky because of all the radiation that was down below us.
Oh, wow.
That was literally what the show was created to represent. I mean, the producers and the writers wrote the show in the context of what would happen if we were hit by a nuclear weapon.
Right.
I mean, multiple nuclear weapons in this country, right? I don't know how many people know that. That's why Jetsons is set in the sky.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's a little known fact about the show, but it's just crazy how in some capacity that might actually have been, just like the Simpsons predicted a Trump presidency, the Jetsons might have predicted the future American economy. So I want to shift now to a little bit about you now. We've kind of talked a lot about mental health and politics and what have you.
I did love seeing Kamala in the debate. I will say that.
Okay, so let's talk about Kamala for a few minutes. And now let me ask this again. Not knowing context here, so I'm trying to put context here. Are you from the same part of India that she's from?
I'm not. No, but she is South Indian, and I am too.
So, okay. So, can you give context of who, what part of India you're from, and what part she's from?
I'm from Andhra Pradesh. My family is Telugu, and she's half Tamil. So.
Okay, got it. Okay. So, tell me about it's interesting because I think our generation, right, like people that are 45 and younger. And I know you're much younger than I am, so I don't want to make you feel old. But I'm trying to say basically our second generations are you know, the people who are like basically 0 to 45, that big swath. I think we're more inclined to embrace and accept Kamala for her South Asian roots. One thing I'm noticing, and the reason I bring up this age range is because I look at like my mom's generation, and they are proactively running away from Kamala, which is interesting. I've even heard some people in her generation wanting to vote for this guy named Sunil Freeman, who's running as the vice president under the Peace and Freedom ticket. And like, oh, he's a brown guy, so I'll vote for him. But wait a second, what about the brown woman? You're not giving her the... And I don't believe this practice of voting for somebody just because they're brown. But that's what the logic is happening. I'm seeing upon my mom's generation of, oh, well, this guy's brown, so I'm going to vote for him. But you're running away from Kamala. She's also brown. And I believe there was someone said out there that, or at least there was some observation that growing up, that there were people that kind of shunned her because her mom, who was South Indian, had married a black guy. And that's like, oh, like, you know, it's like, can't accept her, right? And that's sad if you ask me that. We're thinking that there are people who think that.
Right.
But what does Kamala represent? I mean, how does she bring out and show the best of who, I mean, even though she's half Indian, half South Asian, how does she truly represent who we are as a people to you?
Well, question, why are you noticing older family members of yours rejecting her?
Well, the reason I brought up her parents, or her parents' marriage, is because that's one of the things I've heard. Like, her dad's black, and therefore screw that. Like, they view her, they're almost disowning her for having a black dad.
Okay.
I've actually heard that, and let's just be honest, that's quite racist if you ask me.
Quite common too.
Right, yeah, it is quite common, right? And then you hear there's other people who say she's not Hindu enough. I'm like, well. And then there are other people, and this is what really is interesting, and I'm still trying to figure this out. There are still people who are, actually, I'm going to phrase it this way. This is what was phrased to my mom, okay? So I'm going to bring up my mom for a minute. My mom is voting for, I'll tell you she's voting for Biden-Harris. She's more, a lot more emotional, at least she's a lot more vocal about her emotions against Trump than I am. And all of her friends are somehow either in the Trump camp or in the other camp. They're doing everything they can to avoid the Democratic ticket, okay? Most of them are somehow leaning towards Trump. And the one thing that was said to her was like, vote for Trump like you're voting for Modi, who's the Prime Minister of India, mm-hmm. right? And then my mom's like, well, wait, I live in the United States. What does Modi have to do with me? And then to which she was asked, and I actually heard this guy, I was in the room with her when this conversation happened, and she had it on speakerphone, so I heard everything. Her friend asked her, or said to her, like, well, you're not Indian then. Like, her Indianness was robbed from her because she wasn't voting for Trump. To which I say, like, why is that a thing? Right? Like, and the logic is Trump is pro India, Biden is pro Pakistan, therefore we should all give Biden the middle finger and all get behind Trump or somebody else, right? And I'm like, my response is like, well, we're not living in India. We're living in the United States. Like, if you want to go support Modi and support Indian policies and those that matter to you, then maybe you should reconsider where you are. Because as far as I'm concerned, as much as I'm Indian as my roots, I'm born here, but my roots are Indian. I love my culture, but I live here. My grandkids, I'm sorry, my niece and nephew live here. My godkids live here. American policies are going to have more of an impact upon me and my niece and my nephew and my goddaughters than anything else in India. And so my vote should not be upon whether a presidential candidate is pro-India or pro-Pakistan. That's so low down the totem pole. But to answer your question, Anisha, I think that's what people are doing. They place that one concept, that one policy of pro-India versus pro-Pakistan so high up the ladder that's how they're making their decisions.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I'm observing. I mean, again, it seems like this is more than just a little blip on the radar, that this is happening nationwide.
Right. I mean, that reminds me of just the older generation, because many of them are the ones who immigrated. They're just holding on to their old culture. They're holding on to their old life and their old identity. And, you know, we got to move forward and be present. But if they don't want to, I kind of would agree with you. Well, then go back.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, because I before all this, I started observing all this, I'd always chuckle, like, because I've been to India a few times in the past few years. And then I compare that to what I see here with the Indian Americans who emigrated here in the 60s and 70s. And I always say, like, if you want to see 1970s India, visit any city in the United States. Because 1970s India is alive and kicking in the U.S. The India that is today is no longer the India that my parents or my parents' generation remember. But they're still holding on to it.
Right. And if they went back today, they wouldn't feel comfortable there.
Right. I would clarify, if they go back there to live. I mean, I think they still go back to visit.
They go back there to live. Yes.
Right. Yeah. And they would totally not be comfortable with where the country is going. That's not saying India doesn't have a lot of work to do. I mean, one thing that drives me crazy, it's a very small observation, but it drives me up a wall. So I fly a lot within India once I'm there. I'm very good at visiting other cities. And there are times I'll go with my mom, because my mom was visiting too. She grew up there, right? And so let's say we're at Mumbai Airport. And we're flying to, I don't know, I remember last time we went with her, we were flying to Goa. So we're at the airport, and we have to go through two separate lines. There's a male line and a female line, mm-hmm. right? And we have to separate, and then we have to find our way back to the other side of security, right? We go to a hotel, same thing. There's a female entrance, there's a male entrance. Like, it's all separated. I'm like, what in the actual fuck? Like, why is this acceptable? And I always yell. I mean, I'm yelling at my mom. I'm not yelling at my mom, but I'm yelling. I'm venting to my mom. Like, why is this acceptable? Right? I can't get my head around that this world still exists somewhere.
Right.
You know. And so India still leaves work to do. Right. Okay. I don't want to sit here and say India has progressed that much.
Yeah, we're talking about, in many ways, it is. It is more. You know, it's not so conservative in the culture and lifestyle as much.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, that's what I'm observing in terms of politics. So I don't know. I mean, what are you seeing? Are you seeing this? I mean, what is your interactions? And again, to bring back the question of, like, where does Kamala fit on our spectrum of how she represents us?
You know, I think it's really planting the possibility of seeing an Indian or a South Asian woman in a position of leadership in this country and seeing her in politics. It's exciting. I've never seen that before. So that's why I was very drawn and excited to watch the debate. It's fulfilling a part of our potential that I didn't know we could do, you know, or that I hadn't really seen before. And to see a woman do that and to speak eloquently and to take up her own space and to have a strong voice and a strong opinion, that's inspiring to me, because even in my own personal life, I've struggled with that, to be able to have my own opinion and have my own voice. So to see it on a larger scale and to see it in another industry, it just makes me feel like, oh, I guess, you know, it expands me, truly. That's what I feel at the end of the day. I'm not saying she's perfect, you know, I'm not saying, maybe even some parts of me don't trust her fully, and that's my own stuff, or that's our own, you know, community in and of itself of being Indian, and how, you know, we have a lot of competitiveness and combativeness within it, but, you know, the bigger part of it is that I'm inspired.
I want to share something with you about me personally, because there is something about Kamala that truly represents me, like personally me. And this is something you don't know about me, but I'm going to share it because it's fun. So like I said, I've been in politics my whole life. I mean, I was every night I was forced to watch nightly news. I had to read the LA Times front page every single day before I went to school. That was just requirement. And I kind of embraced that life really early. I remember when I was six, maybe seven, I still remember this. It's one of my childhood memories. I would go on my back. I would first go to my bedroom. I put on a suit, and my little seven-year-old suit. Then I'd go downstairs to the backyard, and I'd pretend I'm at a campaign rally because I'm running for office. Like, I had dreams as a kid of running for office. And by the time I was old enough to understand the political spectrum and all that came with it, I started having ambitions of running for U.S. Senate and running for the White House and being the first California Indian senator and being the first Indian in the White House. And Kamala Harris is the first South Asian to represent us in the U.S. Senate, and she might be the first South Asian representative of the White House. She is literally realizing my childhood fantasy.
Right.
Politically, right? Like, that was she is manifesting the world I wanted to see in my lifetime, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, it's personal. Like, and again, just like you said, I've gotten from a policy perspective, I have my issues with her. There are certain things I've studied. I mean, I've been following her and studying her since she was in San Francisco. Not just as Attorney General for the state, but when she was the DA there. And there are certain actions that she did as San Francisco DA, which made me more than scratch my head. It's like, well, what is up with you? It's like, this ain't cool. So I have my qualms about her from a policy perspective, but at the same time, when I look at what the possibilities are in terms of the barriers are being broken, that to me far outweighs the beef I have with her, right? And seeing her manifest my childhood dream is like, I'm not feeling like, oh, fuck you for taking my dream. I'm like, dude, if I can't do it, you go right ahead, right?
I wonder, is there something that feels satisfied within you? You know, because like our mirror neurons, you know, that thing you wanted that you like dreamed and imagined, somebody is doing that. Is it, there's something within you that feels like it's reaching that goal in a sense?
Oh, totally. 100%. Because, okay, so I'm going to give you a little more context here because I think it helps enhance the conversation we're having right now. So I went to law school, and I went to law school because my dream was never to be a lawyer. It was always being politics. So I went to law school specifically with political ambitions in mind. Like, as soon as I'm out, I'm going to go over for a campaign. I'll work myself to local office and work my way up to the chain, right? That was my dream, even in law school. 2000, which was, I think, the year 2000, so my second year of law school, that was the Bush-Gore election. And I specifically enrolled in the fall of 2000. I specifically enrolled in an election law class. It was one of the electives I got to take. And the professor who taught election law was the national authority on elections. So we'd have class on a Thursday. The night before, he was on CNN talking about Bush Gore, because that was a crazy election. I don't know if you remember from that, but that was a crazy election, right? And I was 23 years old at the time. And the day that Al Gore conceded the election, it was a couple of days after Supreme Court voted 5-4 in favor of Bush, the Bush-Gore trial, right? And the Supreme Court officially handed Bush the election on party lines. The five conservatives voted for Bush. I guess my lack of maturity at 23, I was so disillusioned by that election that I gave up on politics. Like, I literally said, you know what? This is not life for me. I do not want to be. I was so upset and so hurt by that I gave up on my entire dream. Went out the day that Al Gore gave his concession speech, and little by little, I've kind of come back. Right now, I cover politics as a journalist, so I'm still kind of in this space now, anyway. Just not in the same capacity I envisioned. But to answer your question, this is my way of getting here to answer your question is, I feel like seeing her on the ticket has brought me back. It's not like I'm putting my eggs in her basket, but I have faith again. The faith I lost 20 years ago is actually back now. I'm not saying I'm going to run for office now, But I am being much more active politically than I used to be, especially this year. I actually have friends of mine who are running for office. A good friend of mine right now is running for city council in the city of Fullerton. I have another friend of mine who's running for LA City Council. I mean, I'm seeing friends of mine who I've interacted with at some capacity are now running for office, and I'm fully getting behind their campaign somehow. You know, I'm supporting them monetarily, or I'm sure the next couple of weeks I'm going to start promoting them on social media. You know, saying, hey, if you live in these cities, go in your districts, go vote for them. So, yes, to answer your question, seeing her be on the ticket, even if she loses, I mean, this is not going to be about, it's not a win or loss thing. Even if she loses, just the fact she made it this far, it's not just satisfying. It's reinvigorating. I'm like, I feel like I'm back to my old political self. The child that used to exist is back. Except now it's this time. Except this time, the child has experienced maturity, so I know how to react differently. Right.
It's huge. Your hope and faith has been reignited, you know, because of just seeing her in this position. That's amazing.
Yeah. And hey, look, that's not to say just because I feel this way that you have to, I'm not going to tell anybody that you have to vote for her. Your vote is your vote. And I'm very big on that. Like, I hope enough people vote for the people that I'm supporting. But, you know, I am. Look, everyone's entitled to their opinions and their vote. And if you feel your candidate is truly the best candidate, whether I agree with you or not, that's not the point. I care just people go out there and vote, and they honestly and authentically express their rights. Because if you don't, then that's when we lose democracy. So I'm never going to tell people that just because I feel this way, you have to feel the same way too. I will never do that. But this is how I feel. This is why it's important to me. And that's one of the reasons why I'm more than from a policy perspective, just from an emotional point of view, this is why I'm voting Biden-Harris. And I'm just being honest about that. And it is where it is. And that's where I am. And if people want to disagree with me upon that, that's their American given right. Right. So, but that's where I am right now.
Yeah, I hear you. I agree with you.
So, let's see. Now, where do we want to go from here? This is kind of an awkward transition now because we had such a deep talk and we've been having a great discussion. But I want to talk to you about what's next for you. I do want to first point out that you and I have one thing in common. You know what that is? You know what that is?
What?
UCLA.
We do. Have that in common.
We're both Bruins. We're both different years, but we're both different eras, but we're both Bruins. So you came out here for college. You came from Toledo, Ohio to go to UCLA. What was that transition like, coming from the Midwest to Westwood?
It was tough, I would say, because I grew up in my town actually was called Holland. It's a suburb of Toledo. So I grew up with the same people since I had moved there. I moved there when I was in fourth grade. So I was eight or nine. And so I knew the same people from 8 to 18, you know, like not that it's not 12 people or something, but the same like couple thousand people I knew. And then to come to UCLA, which was a huge state school and completely different culture and structure of people, I think I was very overwhelmed. And to be away from my home base where, you know, for better or worse, it was about working hard in my family and in the house I grew up in. And I had that structure and I knew what to do and I knew how to deliver in that situation. To go to this whole place of freedom at UCLA and live in a dorm and not know anybody and be completely, you know, overwhelmed. It was challenging. I really think it was really challenging. And I learned what that was how I started to learn how much I needed community.
And so tell us about the community you built at UCLA and what were the challenges in building that community?
I think I didn't know where to start. I went in undecided. I knew I loved performing and I knew I wanted to try to work in entertainment, but I went in undecided. My parents wanted me to be a doctor, you know, typical. So I didn't know where to start. I was trying to take OCHEM classes and then I joined like Bruin News 29 because I was like, maybe I'll do journalism. And then I was trying to take theater classes at the same time. And I think it all started to click when I got into this group called LCC, who's Lapu the Coyote That Cares. It was an Asian American theater company, which is still, you know, up and running. And yeah, we called ourselves Coyotes and we would write and direct and produce and act in our own little sketches and skits and shows and, you know, one act plays every quarter and put up a show and do improvisation and write music and make music videos. And once I found that group of people, because we were like-minded and like-hearted, I felt like I had my own home finally at the school. And that didn't happen until my second year.
Nice. So you find your tribe.
Yeah.
And you're discovering your passion or you're exploring and expanding your passion for the arts and performing. What was that then like, committing to that as a career, and then walk us through the conversation you had with your parents to make that a reality?
I don't know that I ever committed. I was like, I think I studied business economics as my major. I did theater as a minor because you couldn't double major at that time. So I tried to get the most out of my degree, in quotations, the best I could. And then I didn't actually get a job working in, you know, econ or business in that field. Because I wanted truly to work in entertainment. So I thought I would just take some time because I was jobless and just explore entertainment. And then somehow, you know, a year turned into several years. I'm still in entertainment. But yeah, the conversation, I told my dad, I wrote him a letter when I had to decide my third year about what major. And I said, I really want to be a theater major. And he gave me his blessing because I was scared to talk to him about it. And I didn't even end up being a theater major. But, you know, at least I had some sort of permission that I was seeking. And then my mom was always very supportive of if I wanted to do this type of career, she was going to support me. But you know, as I went along over time and over the years and was just in the trenches of pursuing acting and being an actor, she realized so many things about the industry, as I did, of how it's not a meritocracy. And, you know, it really is a hard profession. And, it takes a long time to get to where you want to go. It can take a long time.
Well, your progressing is great. And I in the little time I've known you, I mean this from the bottom of my heart. You're making us proud as Bruins, but also as an Indian American in the business. You're making all of us proud. So don't stop. Keep doing what you're doing. And as my dad always would say when he was around, just doesn't matter what you're doing as long as you're honest and you're the best at it.
Right.
And as long as you're doing those two things, the world's your oyster. Do what you got to do and how you want to do it. And because, you know, I went through the same thing myself. I'm not trying to give a Ira Lade story here, but, you know, I went through the same arc of, you know, well my parents also wanted me to be a doctor. And I always rebelled. I for some reason, going to law school was being rebellious. I don't know how that worked in my family, but my parents, like, you can't go to law school. I'm like, well, watch me, right?
Sense of doctors, lawyers, and engineers of those three options, lawyer is like the least common, I would say.
Yeah, and in my entering law school class, I think I was the only South Asian in my entire class.
Yeah.
Right? You know? And then after all that was done, I chose to become a journalist, which was even more like eyebrow raising, like, what are you doing, Pimo? I'm like, yeah, well, I'm going to go over here. You know, and that's even, it seemed, you know, you want to talk about rarity among South Asians. Imagine how many brown faces I saw when I was out in the field. Almost none. You know, the only South Asian journalists I ran to initially were pretty much in the broadcast space. never met a writer that was like me. I never saw that for years. I still don't see it to this day. I can't tell you how many times I go out and I cover something. And I know I'm in the environmental space. I'm in, you know, maritime, and I'm in a few unique niches, but the lack of diversity that even I see, and it's, you know, so I've kind of, what I've done is to kind of make me feel better about that is I've started mentoring a lot of younger journalists. Like just last weekend, I had a Filipino American journalist who's in Chicago. She was put in touch with me by one of the journalism associations. And, you know, I gave her advice on how to fix it. I told her how to do a resume. She used some articles. I said how to use articles for her work. Like, I'm not trying to, and I told at the end, like, look, there are very few Filipino Americans in this space. And you could be that person, someone 20 years from now, because I said, I want to be like her. And this is why I also want to say to you, like, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, the only brown person I saw on TV was not a brown person. I remember watching this movie, Short Circuit, where the guy played an Indian. He was a white guy played Indian, right? And like, I didn't see Indians on the screen when I was growing up, right? And there's now going to be kids, like my niece is 8 years old. If she's watching something with you in it, and I'll tell her, like, hey, that's my friend. Like, she's going to be excited. She's going to take that seriously. And she's going to be able to relate to, like, hey, there's someone who looks like me. She's brown. I can be like her. I don't have to limit myself to be a doctor, engineer, lawyer. I can go and be like that. And I think that's the value of seeing someone like you succeeding. It's not just for you, it's that pressure. I mean, it's pressure that we unfortunately have, like the group of Indian American women who are with you have that now. Like, you are now a beacon of hope and light to the people who are behind you. And that, to me, that's a beautiful thing. Like, this is what we all have. Like, there are people now who are behind, who are now trailing me and say, hey, look, there's a guy who's succeeding as a journalist. I could be like him, right? And I think that's the takeaway from all this stuff. It's you know, we're doing what we want. We're trying our best. But because of the world we live in now, it's such a, everything's so transparent. We're all out there. It's easy to see who we are. We can't hide as much.
Right.
That our work has a certain value beyond us. And so, this is, again, another reason why the Asian Highway has to exist, because I want to be out there promoting people like you. Mm-hmm. Say, hey, look at what Anisha is doing. Look at what Sarah Connie Lassie was doing, or David Paul Francis from a couple weeks ago. Like, every guest we have, it's not just about interviewing the A-listers.
Yeah.
Right? So with that, I guess it's a good time to say, let's wrap this up, because we could talk forever. But I want to save future conversations to talk about other stuff. So with that, I want to ask you, Anisha, if someone wants to get in touch with you, where's the best way for them to find you?
You can find me on the socials at Anisha Adusmeli, and you can just look up that spelling on the podcast notes.
Yes, I'll make very sure that's on the podcast notes.
yeah, Instagram, Twitter. And yeah, I think that's the place you could find me the most. You can, you know, just Google search me, and you probably find a lot of clips of whatever work you might want to see of me doing. Biffle is on YouTube, B-I-F-L. They're all in capital letters. It's over almost at 1 million views. So I would love for you to watch that. It's 6 episodes all together. It takes about an hour. So it's just like a pilot. And then other than that, I'm constantly staying busy. Right now I am doing a play reading. We're doing minimal rehearsals for this play reading for this local theater in LA called the Blank Theater, and they're doing a living room series, and they're workshopping new plays. So we're still doing theater even during quarantine. So we're doing this whole Zoom recording, and that's going to be up this week. So I'll post a link to that on my social media, and people can get tickets. It can be donation, or you can pay what you can, and you can watch some live theater and continue supporting these theaters during this time when it's really challenging for them. So yeah, that's how I'm staying busy right right now, and then I'm personally continuing to write, and then I'm shooting some short films even in my apartment here in LA with my small creative pod that I have. So as I continue to make stuff and put it out there, that'll be on my social media channels as well.
Excellent. And obviously I'll give a plug for the podcast, for Asian Highway. You can find the podcast Storytellers in Action on all of your favorite podcast platforms. We're on Apple Podcasts and iTunes. We're on Google Play. We're on Spotify. We're on iHeartRadio. Essentially everywhere that you can find your podcast, you'll find us. Just search for Storytellers in Action. And once you find us, be sure to download and subscribe and rate. As I say, all those measures help us become more visible, which helps us get a bigger platform to everybody on our show. And of course, be sure to visit our website, which is 8h1.live, Bollywood reviews, environmental news, South Asian news, Asian American news, all that stuff's on there, sports. So we're regularly up putting stories. So be sure to visit that. This was great, Anisha. So much fun talking to you. And there are other stuff I'd like to talk to you about, but we can save it for a future episode. Yeah. Leave people dangling and wanting more, right?
So nice talking to you.
Yes, so with that, signing off, this is episode 10 of the season, a perfect 10 for us. Thank you, Anisha, again. On behalf of everybody here at the Asian Highway, this is Kimo, and we'll talk to you next week.